Recurring Themes meets every Tuesday and Thursday nights. If you're in New York, look it up online. And I'm always there. It's my home group. Being a city boy, I haven't had much experience sleeping in a tent. Last night, I slept in a tent. I slept well. I want to thank people that supplied the tent, and there was an electric light in there. Who knew there would be a tent with an electric light? I didn't know that was possible. And a sleeping bag and a comforter. I was well taken care of. They hooked me up, as we say in the city. So I want to thank all the people involved. I was told that Virginia in July would be hot.
Hey, awesome. Hey,
for a couple of days.
Nice sweater.
So I planned a really cute outfit for tonight. But if I had worn it, I'd be shivering up here. So these are the warmest clothes I could find. I hope you don't mind. And furthermore, as it gets darker, you're not going to see many details up here. I'm going to be like a silhouette, like the witness protection program anyway. So it probably doesn't matter. The theme for this weekend has been carrying the message. Carrying the message. It's probably the most important thing we do. The primary purpose of our groups is what? Carry the message. We're told we can't keep it unless we give it away. What do you suppose it is? And it's said to be like taking out, it's the best insurance against relapse. So it's something pretty important. Now, we often think of carrying the message as people who speak, people who share at meetings, what they share, that's the message. And it is. But the fifth tradition says all our actions convey a message. All our actions. And it goes on to say, make it a message of recovery. And thinking about carrying the message, I'm drawn to remembering when I arrived at Narcotics Anonymous in January 20th of 1992. We have had a clubhouse in New York City. You may have heard of it. There were round-the-clock NA meetings, and that's where I arrived that day 22 years ago. And I didn't know what to expect. Nobody does at the first NA meeting. And I didn't know what time the meeting was. I just knew where that place was, and I was willing to go there and see what it was. I was very doubtful it was going to be for me, but I was willing to go and see, and I walked in the door, and there wasn't a meeting going on yet, but some people seemed to be getting ready for something. Now I know they were trusted servants, I didn't know. And there was somebody up in front taking great care to line up the key tags, each color in line perfectly, taking great care with that. And it seemed to me, even at that early stage, she was doing it lovingly. That conveyed a message. And I'm sitting there, and I guess it was getting close to meeting time because there were very few people, and then all of a sudden, an onrush of people, and the room was packed. We had a few minutes, and the meeting started. So they knew what time it started, and they arrived, and it was really impressive, whatever. They wanted to be on time, and whatever was going on was important to these people. And then during the meeting, people would share personal stuff. They would share about where they were falling short and how bad they felt about themselves. All the things I had worked very hard to hide. You share them openly. I don't know what to make of this. And when somebody would share something that was tearing them up emotionally, it was very painful. And maybe they even got quiet talking about it, and they were just... The room, you could hear a pin drop at that point. When somebody was in pain and sharing, nobody scraped a chair, nobody coughed, and everyone was leaning forward not to miss anything. Again, I didn't know what was going on, but what was going on was very important to you people. It conveyed a message. And as I kept coming, doubtful that I would stay, but I was curious. This was very strange to me and interesting. And he said the most amazing things. He said, newcomer. He said, newcomer. You know, you stop using drugs, you're counting days. We know at some point you're going to feel a feeling. You're covered up, drugs covered up, you're going to feel an uncomfortable feeling. What we suggest you do is tell us about it. Pick up the phone if you're at home, if you're in a meeting, raise your hand, or pull someone over and talk about it, and then you won't feel so bad. Well, that didn't make any sense to me. Talking about it and then I won't feel so bad if I'm feeling... What's going on? What are you talking about? But a few days later, I was feeling really bad. And I was willing, I'll pull someone over, somebody I'd seen there. And I said, have you got a minute? Well, it took about half an hour. But I'm pouring out my feelings and what happened. And he's listening to a lot of people around us. We don't see them, he's listening, and I'm going through and then this happened, and they said this, and and he's really listening. I'm going on what a bad day it was, and he's like a laser beam. He's hanging on every word. There's stuff around, he's right there. He didn't say anything, he's real. I'm going on, and then I'm talking about it, and I'm talking about it, and I realize I feel better. I feel better. It conveyed a message. The message was, you might be saying things that for somebody new like me made absolutely no logical sense. But if I was willing to try them, it worked. You knew some things that worked that didn't make sense, but if I were willing to try them, I might get the help I need. So I thanked that guy, and I said, yeah, I feel better. You really helped me a lot. You know what he said to me? He said, no, you helped me a lot. I said, no, I felt bad. Now I feel better. You helped me. He said, no, you helped me a lot. I really thought NA was a very strange place. As I kept coming, there was this guy named Miles who took a liking to me, and he was always there when I was there, and he he'd ask me how I'm doing, and he would be visible and available, and he would be available to listen to whatever and how you're doing, especially when I was trying to disqualify myself. I had trouble with the God thing. He'd say stuff like, it doesn't matter, you'll find something, just keep coming. But it'll be fine, you just keep... I had trouble, I was older than most newcomers. I was an old newcomer. He said, that doesn't matter. I had questions. I was trying to disqualify myself, trying to unique myself, and he wouldn't let me. And therefore, his availability for me to ask questions was carrying the message. There was this guy, Billy W., who also was at the meetings there at this clubhouse. And there were times between meetings, because it was around the clock, and it'd be a half an hour between on the steps in front. countless conversations he had with me. Actually, what the conversations were him asking me probing questions and pulling out of me what turned out to be my story. I was all closed up. He would ask me questions about my past and about my feelings, and suddenly I got in touch with some things that caused me to use drugs and caused my disease to progress, and I could see something, and he was carrying the message by asking questions. It isn't always about sharing or speaking. And then there was Johnny O, this guy. Again, these were people that had 8 or 9 years, which in 1992 in New York City was a lot of time. And Johnny O, we have all speaker meetings there, we just do. And when Johnny O was the speaker, every so often he'd be the speaker. And Johnny O had a knack to talk about the program, but he was hilarious. Everyone laughed. I was falling off my seat. He struck me so funny, but he was talking about the program. And the message he conveyed was that while this was serious, deadly, life and death serious, it didn't have to be solemn. Conveyed a message. I kept coming. And I'm sitting there, and certainly at times I put two and two together, and somebody's sharing about something, and I'm thinking I did something or felt something like that. I was learning to identify. That happened, and sometimes that was emotional. But there were other times, I don't know if anyone went through this, there were other times that just suddenly, spontaneously, I would be crying in my seat, and it had nothing to do with what I heard. I would just have these times of tears, and I'd be stifling the sound because I didn't want people to notice, but they could tell. And I would feel a hand on my shoulder to comfort me. And I thought I was going crazy, just crying for no reason. But what they were, I could see later, they were tears of joy. They were tears of joy that I had found the place I'd always been looking for. I had found the group of people I'd always been looking for that were more like me in all the most important ways. All the most important ways. Page 121. Members knew from personal experience exactly how isolated we felt. It seemed as if the whole group knew exactly what we needed. Thanks. Exactly what we needed, like that. Without our having to ask.
Yes.
So I know a lot of us mentioned that one of the most important things early in recovery was people remembered our names.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
A lot of us share that. That meant so much to us. That conveyed a message that we were important, that we mattered. I didn't have that experience because, in a certain way, I messed it up. See, in those first few meetings, when you would come to me and welcome me to Narcotics Anonymous and say, but you said your name was such and such, and you'd ask me what my name was, and I was very doubtful I was going to stay in those early days. I made up a name. And I answered to that name from then on. When I would be counting clean time, counting my days, I'd share my name is that other name. And people would call my that other name, and I thought, yeah. So when they remembered my name, I had mixed feelings. But at a certain point, around 90 days, I don't even remember deciding to do it. My hand went up. I got called on, and I said, my real name. Now, I was so fearful of doing this because I was making friends with you, and I thought you would hate me for that. My real name is Phil, but I'm still an addict. Everybody laughed. I did it in another meeting. Everybody laughed. In the Serenity Circle, that night, people would be looking at me, smiling, and going like this. As if to say, boy, you really belong here. Conveyed a message that if I am honest, you will understand. And I will get better and not have to wear a mask and masquerade. That I can be me. That meant a lot. Just taking that risk and seeing how wonderful it went. Then I felt more part of. Also was able to go by Phil. The thing about sharing, you know, I could hear people share different things, and I'm still closed up, and I don't exactly want you to know all about me, but I knew that part of this thing was sharing something, so I started with the safe stuff. And, you know, you shared about the crazy things you did when you were using active addiction, and so I started, I raised my hand and I shared about walking the streets of New York high as a kite, and I would get in arguments with complete strangers about them walking too fast behind me, they're walking too slow in front of me. I would be screaming at them, complete strangers, directing traffic on the sidewalk. I couldn't take me anywhere. I'd go to a restaurant and I'd pick something wrong with the service and make a scene, and they'd pay and they'd usher me out, and I couldn't go back there. And this was my version of some of my crazy active behavior. New York, there are a lot of tourists, active, walking down the street high. Tourists would ask me directions to someplace. I'm a native New Yorker, I know New York. I would send them in the wrong direction. I wouldn't hold doors for people. I'd get a certain delight in letting go of it and letting them slam in the face. This was my version of, you know, how crazy I was back then. That's all that was safe enough at that point. In time, I was able to talk about having destroyed a business I had for 20-some years, a one-man business that gave me my little bit of self-esteem. And how I got a brilliant idea one day. It was getting a little boring. I'd been doing it a long time. And I thought if I could just get a little high, early in the day, and then I could just go on automatic pilot. And that was some brilliant idea, because one by one I lost clients and I destroyed my business. And I was hearing people share about things they destroyed in active addiction, so I was able to share that. But then the big one was, and I really didn't want to share this, you know, it seemed like most of the people where I made meetings were on welfare or public assistance or lived in shelters or something like that. And that wasn't my story. My rent was paid. I didn't lose everything. I lost everybody. And in active addiction, I would take an annual vacation. Now, I chose where I took my vacation carefully. I chose a country known for the availability of drugs. And I went there and copped through the language barrier, culture barrier, funny money barrier. But I was reluctant to share this because I'm in a room full of people that don't take international vacations. one day, I took a deep breath and shared it, and people listened intently. And at the end of the meeting, there was a circle around me. They were fascinated. They wanted to know more about it. And one guy, I remember, said, "Hey, that reminds me of dodging bullets in the South Bronx." He identified with the dereliction. I had abandoned myself and my own best interests, just like he did dodging bullets. Again, if I could be honest, that conveyed a message that people could identify. They could make that transposition from their experience to my experience. All these things convey a message. Now, page 160, here we go. The message may be voiced in many ways. That we won't use, if we won't use drugs, we won't get loaded. But if we stand under the tree, we won't get rained on. No, no, no. That they found satisfying lives in recovery. Even though life may be painful, we can stay clean. It's voiced in many ways. And then it says, and it works how and why, the spiritual awakening we experience when we work the steps, is also our message. The spiritual awakening that comes from working the steps. So whatever we share on the steps and what we get out of them, that's the message also. In the first step, I had to realize the enormity of my problem. That the disease wasn't some little thing. The disease touched all areas of my life. And thank goodness for those many questions in the step working guide. Thank goodness for questions like, do I fall apart emotionally when things don't go according to my plan? Do I throw a temper tantrum? Or do I take a challenge as a personal insult? Or does my personality change when I'm acting out of my addiction? These questions make it vivid in the present with clean time that my disease is alive and well and powerful. That powerless word in the first step, that's hardly used in that world out there. That's a funny word for them. We use it all the time. It's meant to indicate how powerful our disease is. In the second step, I had to realize that when I get a thought, and they're always self-destructive thoughts, of what I want to do or what I don't want to do, I need to run it by people. I need to ask for help. I need to not trust my thinking. I need to take the action of sharing what I want to do may not be good for me, so I don't do it. Or share what I don't want to do, like pay a bill or something, so I do do it. I need to let people know about my brilliant ideas. I told you one of them before. In the third step, I have a control problem. I know I'm not the only one here who has a control problem. I'd like to find a switch that would stop the rain, but control problem, you know? I want something this way I want it, and I want it now. A lot of times in my service history in New York City, I'm the person in the group that finds speakers. Well, all our meetings are speaker meetings, so we have a great need for speakers in New York. They call it secretaries, they call it speaker seeker, different groups, different things, but they often ask Phil to get speakers. So it's a topic meeting or it's a step meeting, and I get a brilliant idea of so-and-so is perfect. He'll have to come. That night, that step, that's it. I merely call him to let him know. Control issue. Willful, self-will. I call him, typically, and then maybe the person hesitates. I'm not sure about that date. Is something, can you change it? I'm twisting the arm. I'm insisting that he accept my invitation to, because he's perfect. And I can only think of one thing. It has to happen. What usually happened when I did that was they'd either not show at all or show up with a bad attitude. They were pissed off that I insisted they come. I've subsequently learned to turn it over. When I hear that, I say, that's all right, that's all right. I'll get back to you on another day. I call and go to plan B. I go to my second choice. And they're able to come, and it works out beautifully. And that's the point of the third step. When we get out of God's way, things work out beautifully. Beautifully. It takes practice because it goes against the grain. I want what I want. I think I know what's in my best interest. Over time, I will be removed of that belief. But the third step, I still feel that way. The fourth step, I wrote about some of my issues. Some of my issues are that I have great guilt about being a bad son to my mother. Bad son to my mother. I was an only child. I was the apple of her eye. She wanted me to be important in her life, but I didn't like the way she brought me up. So when I got old enough to move out of the house, I did drive-bys. I did surface sharing. I kind of abandoned her. And in a lot of ways, I broke her heart. She died before I got to NA. She never met this film. Felt a lot of guilt about that. There was something about me all my life that when I make a mistake, it isn't just a mistake. It's a tragedy. It's a crisis. It's a big deal. It can be some little thing. I'm not allowed to make a mistake. It's mood-altering. I'd be bummed out if I'm supposed to bring something somewhere and I left it at home, or I said something one way and I could have said it another way, and I'm working it through, and I'm bad Phil. Something about me. Mistake is not a trivial matter for me. I wrote about it in my fourth step. I wrote about how I had a lot of trouble with relationships. I told you I lost everybody, not everything. I mean, I would pick people to be in my life. Now, I wouldn't look for them to be interested to be in my life. I just picked them, and they're going to be in my life. I told you I'm willful. And you know, they escaped a lot of people. But even the ones that stuck around a while, either I would grow sick of them, or more often they would grow sick of me. They wouldn't stick around. I hear people had lifetime friendships even before recovery, and I mean, that seemed impossible for Phil. And my complaint was always, they weren't real. They started out this way and they turned out to be that way. They weren't real. And I'm disappointed in them. My disappointed was the most used word in my fourth step. Showed up at my sponsors for my fifth step. Brennan, the fourth step, he's taking notes, he's taking it all in. Finish. Now I'm going to hear my listener's objective response to what I shared. He said, Phil, you said these people in your life, they weren't real. Now, I've been listening to them, everything you've been saying, and you did say that when you got pissed off at one of them, or that they didn't do what you wanted them to do, you wouldn't say anything to them about it. You kept that to yourself. I think you said you made a list for everyone. Now, I'm not the only one that did that, am I? Anyone make a list of all the times people piss you off or didn't? You made lists, Phil. Who wasn't real? Sponsor is pointing out some difficult stuff in the fifth step. Fifth step can be a difficult one to go through and listen to these truths. He said, you were disappointed in all these people, this one, disappointed. Who picked these people to be in your life, Phil? He went on to say, and this thing about making mistakes, you know, gee, you made that mistake, huh? you didn't do it the way you wanted to do it. You did it. I bet Perfect Phil would have done it the other way. I bet Perfect Phil wouldn't have made that mistake. Perfect Phil, he kept jabbing me with that. And what he was saying was so valuable to me. He was saying I was comparing myself to a perfect version of myself. What an unfair comparison. He gave me some really important things. And about my guilt issue with my mother, what he said didn't get rid of it, but it planted a seed. I was talking about back then, when I was active, before NA, the bad things I said to her and how I had little to do with her and all these things. He said, Phil, you were undiagnosed. At first I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't know I had a disease. I didn't know I was acting on the self-centeredness of the disease. But I'm blaming myself, and I didn't know I was a sick person. We can all look at our past history prior to day one and try to forgive ourselves because we didn't choose to have this disease. Now, it would be nice after 5 steps and all this self-awareness if our behavior changed like that. If now we're better, we know. Now I don't have to be, I don't have to be perfect, Phil. I can, I made a mistake. I don't have to feel bad about my mother. Doesn't work that way. See, knowing who we are doesn't stop us from being who we are. So I needed a 6-step. I needed a 6-step, and I needed to see defects for what they were. I needed to see perfectionism. I already talked about that. The dishonesty of keeping a list for people of things that haven't said to them directly, but they're on my mind, and your list gets too long, and you're out of my life. That's dishonest. I had a fear of confrontation, but that didn't excuse it. They didn't get a chance to clarify or work through anything. I kept that to myself, dishonest. Whenever you're walking on the sidewalk and bawling people out for how they're using my sidewalk, that was arrogance. And thinking back, my mother long passed away, how I could have, should have, would have done something differently way back in the 70s, and shouldn't have said that to her. I could have shown up more. I could have, should have, would. Remorse is a defect. Remorse, regretting the past. 7-step, whole different step. 6 and 7 are not the same step. 6-step, I'm trying not to do it. I'm not going to be remorseful. But I'm thinking about it, and there it is again. And the whole hour went by, and I'm mood altered. But I cannot change myself. What the literature says about the 6-step, it says it in the 7-step, what entirely ready really means. It says we were tired of our shortcomings or defects. We were worn out after the 6-step. From trying to manage and control, and we wanted some relief. The purpose of the 6-step is to get tired, is to be worn out, is to fail at trying to change ourselves. We similar to trying to stop using drugs by ourselves. How successful was that? But we had to try that first. Then we were open when I got Anonymous. So in the 7-step, we do something quite different. We practice the spiritual opposite. Practice doesn't mean do it perfect. It means make an effort. First efforts at new things, not perfect, but we're making an effort. So try a little humility, Phil, walking on the street, and instead of bawling out these strangers, you're just another pedestrian, just another sidewalk walker. Walk around them or wait for them to fill. Be humble. You're just another. You're not directing traffic on the sidewalk. How about some compassion for self when I'm imperfect, when I make a mistake? Instead of this, how about a little compassion for self? So far as the remorse and the past and my mother and not being the son I could have been, instead of trying to rewrite history, how about a little acceptance? It went down the way it went down. It's in the books. I can't change it. How about saying, it's done? Get over it. Acceptance. And as far as being pissed off and not letting people know, how about trying to take a risk and practicing integrity, being who you seem to be, and tell them that you wish they had done something differently. And go through whatever happens when you say that. It's not the end of the world. And I practiced doing these things and other things for other defects. And as I practiced, I realized that the whole periods of time, it wasn't there. I wasn't trying to fix history with my mother. I wasn't trying to keep things to myself. I took the risk and we worked through something and I kept a friendship instead of discarding it. I was kinder to Phil and I didn't feel bummed out the rest of the day just because I left something at home or some damn thing. Defects get removed. The eighth step. I had to get in touch with the nature of the harm of the people I put on the list. The nature of the harm. With my mother, I was pretty clear that I was insensitive and I had abandoned her. And, the nature of the harm. I was selfish. I was in the self-centeredness of the disease. I had to write about that. As far as, not holding doors for people and the sidewalk stuff, I realized that was willfulness. That was willfulness. I wanted what I wanted. I wanted them to walk a certain way on my sidewalk. And as far as because I was on the list too, I put myself on the list for putting myself in harm's way. When I was in these countries, I was risking Midnight Express type prisons. I was risking violence trying to cop in these dangerous countries. I deserve to be on the list. I believe we all deserve to be on the eight-step list, by the way, because all of us come into recovery with what? Self-loathing, self-hatred. And it relates to that undiagnosed piece. We didn't know that we had a disease. We thought we were bad people. Instead, we are sick people. So from having self-loathing for self, we deserve to be on the eight-step list. And the ninth step, I went to my mother's gravesite. I read the letter. And the ninth step is much more than just an apology. Much more. Some of it, I got something said to the gravestone. The gravestone didn't say, yes, I understand, or anything. Read it to the gravestone. Cried my eyes out. But I have strived to be the son she would have wanted me to be. And it gives me comfort that she's looking down and seeing this Phil, whom she never met, and that she's pleased. Society, I hold doors for people. I hold elevator doors. I wouldn't think of getting out of an elevator without holding the door for who's ever getting in. I don't litter. I behave myself in restaurants without making a scene. It's amends to society. See, it's not just mending our fences. It's mending our ways. And it's amends to self. So I try to be good to myself. I try not to beat myself up. I try to not put myself in jeopardy. I eat right, stuff like that. In the 10th step, it says these changes, because there have been a lot of changes in 9 steps, these changes are not guaranteed to be permanent. It says that in the step working guide. I've been the other Phil longer than I've been this Phil. So they're a little shaky. I have to maintain. And the quality I need for this 10th step is vigilance. I need to be vigilant. I need to pay attention. It comes from the word vigil. Vigil. When something happens, somebody's killed or there's some tragedy, Very often neighbors or the community meet somewhere in a central place with candles, and they sit there, often through the night. That's a vigil. To be vigilant, in the dictionary, means to be awake while other people are sleeping. To practice the 10th step, I have to be awake to my current, present behavior. I have to be really aware and on top of it. And when I'm wrong, I have discovered, I can admit I'm wrong, and the ceiling doesn't fall in, the floor doesn't open up, the person says, okay. Then I don't have to be thinking about it and compensating for it and defending it. What a relief. And the 10th step isn't all about being wrong. It's also about preventing our doing something where we're going to have to admit we're wrong. And I have a thing about buffet restaurants. You know, all-you-can-eat restaurants? You know, they have a sign up there that says, you know, just eat what you eat here. You're not supposed to take it home. But I went through a period where I would bring Ziploc bags to buffet restaurants. And this was for tomorrow's lunch, and this was for Thursday's dinner, and this was for, you know, here's a snack, and I'd fill up my, you know. So I have to stay away from buffet restaurants because that's the place where I'm liable to do something where I have to admit I'm wrong. The 11th step. By now, I have a heartfelt belief in my fallibility. It's pretty darn likely that what I think is in my best interest and what really has to happen, it's got to happen. I want it to happen. I'm going to make it happen. What I think is in my best interest, very often is not. The sure I am, very often it's not in my best interest at all. So the 11th step asks me to ask myself this kind of a question. Let me pay attention to what's happening, situations, events, or hearing somebody say something. Might this be communication from this higher power that I've been developing a relationship with? Might this be a form of communication? That situation, too much of a coincidence, there's a message. Or maybe it isn't. Most of the time it isn't when I'm asking this question. I'm not that important. Not everything is. But every so often, boy, it's clear cut. I'm supposed to go that way, not that way. And then I have to be willing to go that way. Sometimes if I want something to happen, and I'm just hitting a wall wherever I try to make this thing happen. A relationship or a space for a meeting or something like that. My sponsor says if it's too much of a struggle, it's not God's will. And I have to say, whoops, turn that off, stop trying, leave it alone. Whole different way of looking at events in my life. And I have to pay attention to who's put in my path. I told you I used to pick people. I want you to be in my life. Oh, you're not that interested? Well, I'm going to be so charming and wonderful and good to you. You're going to want to be in my life. I'm going to twist your arm. You know, that was my thinking. 11th step says, pay attention. Who's put right in your path? Deal with them. And because I've done that, I have a lot of the most wonderful people I know that are an important part of my life. People have been sent to me that are just perfect for me and to be in my life. And I pay attention. And I don't go picking somebody over there and trying to reel them in. Who's in my path? It's a whole different way of looking at life. And then I get to the 12th step, but I know my time is short. And the 12th step is the one where, about carrying the message, isn't it? So I must do service, and I do service in the group level. For years I did it area level in that area. And I sponsor a lot of guys. And I talk to people who are not my sponsees. I allow a lot of phone time. I have a cell phone. I'm a little cheap. I don't like paying the monthly charge. But I have a cell phone, so I'm really not just visible, but available. I show up at court if somebody has a court thing, I show up in hospitals. I show up when somebody is going back to the doctor to get their HIV results, and I've had several guys cry on my shoulder at those moments. This is what we do. And I remain visible and available. My thing in a meeting is I survey the meeting while it's going on, and if it's somebody with a really sad face or somebody shares something that I really relate to, and I'm over here and they're over there, when we form the serenity circle, my thing is I'm over on that side so that as soon as we say the prayer, I can say, hey, want to talk? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I make the effort. I relocate on the other side. That's my thing. And some of us I know share like Shakespeare in meetings, get a lot of attention. Newcomers come and ask for their number. They give their number out freely. And then we hear, when I call so-and-so, he's never home, or I always get the machine, or I got him once, but he was on his way out. He said he'd call me back. That's not okay. That is not okay. All our actions convey a message. That conveys a really bad message for NA. It's not okay to give your number as if you are available and not be available. The newcomer doesn't care how much we know until they know how much we care. And here's the thing, we're talking about selfless service here. Selfless service. By the 12th step, we can afford something we couldn't afford at the beginning. We can afford to be generous, a generosity of spirit. By the 12th step, we truly are there for people and want nothing from them. That's astounding. That's a spiritual awakening, isn't it? 23, here we go. We don't ask anything of the people to whom we're trying to carry the message. We don't ask anything. We don't ask for money. We don't ask for gratitude. We don't even ask that they stay clean. We want them to stay clean, but how our message turns out is none of our business. We don't make them stay clean anyway. We just have to do our job. We simply extend ourselves. So I can afford to give a lot to this person here because all my needs are met by somebody over here, somebody over here, and somebody there, and somebody I don't even know who just showed up and answered some of my needs. I don't need anything from you. I do this selflessly. And that's amazing for somebody who used to be real, real selfish. And finally, it's important that even when I'm not around NA and not talking to an NA person, newcomer, old timer, or whatever, when I'm out there, that I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. In all my affairs. So I'm the guy in New York City when there's a blind person waiting at the corner, waiting for the light to change, as if they can see when the light's going to change. Maybe they're listening for the click. We'll offer, can I take you across the street, or do you want to know when it changed? It just changed now if you want to go. No, I'll go a little to the right. I'm the blind people just tear me up because I can't imagine being that vulnerable as to be a blind person crossing a street in Manhattan. And there I am holding doors for people. Nobody, no other people are looking. I'm not going to get any points. And today, if one of those tourists ask Phil for directions, they get good directions. They get accurate. I walk them part way. I am Mr. Helpful. All my affairs, and it doesn't matter if any of you can see me doing the right thing. I have a relationship with a higher power who's looking down. And the 12th step says, God helps us as we help each other. And what that means to me is, in order to get the many blessings that I've gotten over the years and I'm currently receiving, it has some connection. I'm not doing it. These things benefit us too. When we carry the message, answering the questions of others, our own thinking becomes clearer. Somebody asks me a question, I put it into words. I understand it, but I never put it into words. Now I'm clearer about it. Or I'm sharing with somebody, I'm listening to them say, a sponsor calls me, they're stealing time at work, and I'm carrying the message by pointing out that that's not spiritual, that they're trying to get chores, that they need to give a full day's work for a full day's pay. Don't let that person check you out, that's wrong, that's being a rule breaker, that's being rebellious. And then the same day, I go to the gym where I swim, and I go through the place where there's showers before the gym where it says everyone who enters the pool must take a shower, and Phil doesn't take a shower, and I'm talking to them about them being rule breakers, and the same, carrying the message helps us too. But when I'm out there, even though none of you can see, my higher power can see, and there's some connection between all the benefits I'm getting and me trying to do the right thing. So I'm going to continue to try to do the right thing and try to carry the message in lots of ways, because all our actions, not just words, are we walking the talk? All our actions convey a message. Thanks for letting me share.
Name Cindy. Let's see, where are we at? Oh no. That's at the registration table. Who has a gist for today?
I'm an addict named Mary. I'm from the Blue Ridge area. My home group is a new one, and it doesn't have a name yet.
All right.
Just for today, tell yourself.
So,
God will be on my.